Roman opens campaign September 18th at Des Moines, Iowa, plowing contest.
Dewey launches attack at Des Moines, Iowa, Drake University.
Uh-oh, here we go again.
Living 1948, brought to you each week at this time by NBC and its affiliated stations, holds up its mirror today on the threshold of campaign time USA to reflect the history and anatomy of political campaigning in a drama document entitled
Vote for Me.
And here, distinguished because he is not running for any political office, is your narrator, Clyde Cattell.
Greetings, voters, one and all. This, as Lord Bryce, British student of American affairs, once put it, is a time of great shakings in America. Great shakings passing into the hot pit of presidential elections. And indeed it is. A time when everyone can join the fun, and virtually everyone does. To the tune of brass bands, loudspeakers, speeches, flag waving, and words our mothers never taught us. Throughout the forthcoming pre-November days, at least 30,000 hopefuls, all aspirants for some public office, are ready to spend a total of about $75 million to convince you, the little man with the ballot in his hot little hand, to
vote for me.
Always, some would be, already, some would be candidates have dropped by the wayside, like this one in Illinois.
I have no desire to subject myself to such vituperation and abuse.
Already, to help their candidates to victory, women workers of one party have planned,
we women will set up central nurseries on election day and serve as babysitters for all good mothers.
And already, the mud has begun to fly.
I say to you, my friends, my opponent is un-American. I say to you, my friends, if my opponent is elected, democracy will die.
Yes, campaign time USA is here. A bigger show than Barnum's, the World's Fair, the New York St. Patrick's Day Parade, and any $5 million Hollywood musical all rolled into one. A fitting time, is it not, while we still have our wits about us, to ask ourselves,
where did all this start? How did we get here?
How do campaigns work?
Do they really change votes?
How can we cast an intelligent ballot?
Stand by, America, as we swing you around a circle within the political circle.
General Jackson, sir?
Yes?
The steam is ready, General, to take you to New Orleans. Will you come aboard, sir?
With pleasure, friend. By the eternal, this is one time we let the people see and judge for themselves a candidate for the presidency. After you, my good friend.
Our campaign system, America, began as so many traditions in our political life began, with Andrew Jackson. Yes, in 1828, the people, for the first time by direct ballot, were to choose their own leaders.
No one knew it then, but that day something was started that was never to pass out of American life. The selling of a candidate to the American people. This first campaign, too, saw the birth of the campaign paper, full of black charges against the opposing candidate.
The anti-Jackson press.
Andrew Jackson is a bloodthirsty butcher, a merciless killer of Indians and deserters.
Andy Jackson is an adulterer. He married his wife before she divorced her first husband.
The other side was no less slanderous.
The pro-Jackson press.
John Adams took public money to buy a billiard table, which he dared set up in the White House.
John Adams used public funds to repanel one of the White House rooms, then let his mother hang her wash to dry in it.
Thus did our campaign system get off to a rousing start and keep right on rolling.
...1840, Martin Van Buren, Democrat, versus General William Henry Harrison, Whig.
Harrison, hero of Tippecanoe, had not much more than his war record to go on. Just as the Whigs were about to despair of getting a real campaign underway, the Democrats handed them their opening.
Give Harrison a barrel of hard cider and a pension of $2,000 a year, and take my word for it, he'll sit for the remainder of his days in a log cabin.
Well, that's all the Whigs needed. With unbridled glee, they jumped upon the characterization. Floats were made with models of log cabins, and men sat beside them drinking hard cider. As behind, paraders swung through the streets singing,
"Oh, Gypsy wears a homespun suit. He has no ruffled shirt. But then he has the golden plate, and he's a little squirt."
And so to the spitting of tobacco juice and taunts of,
"Bam, bam, the used up man."
And shouts of,
"Tippecanoe and Tyler too."
Van Buren fell to the feet before the man who liked a Buckeye bench and liquor.
"Here I am, soldier. That true-hearted soldier. The gallant old soldier of Tippecanoe."
Grover Cleveland, Democrat, against James G. Blaine, Republican.
The birth of the whispering campaign.
I tell you, my dear, it's common gossip. Grover Cleveland is the father of an illegitimate child.
You don't say.
The delighted Blaine forces march down the streets chanting,
"Ma! Ma! Where's my pa?
Up in the White House, darling!
Making the laws!
Valiantly, the Cleveland forces counterattack.
"Blaine! Blaine! James G. Blaine! The continental liar from the state of Maine!"
But it's Grover Cleveland himself who kills the rumor with the simple remark,
"Tell the truth."
There never was any proof that Cleveland was the father of the child. Cleveland was elected.
William McKinley, Republican, versus William Jennings Bryan, Democrat.
This campaign was interesting for the origin of two campaign methods, which we've all come to know, that the opposing candidates used. Mr. Bryan.
"I plan to stump the country, to take my case to the far reaches of this great nation, to let as many free Americans see and hear me as is within my power to do so."
And why not? Bryan was young, strong. How could the older McKinley match this? Announced his famous campaign manager, Marcus Alonzo Hanna.
"Mr. McKinley will conduct a front porch campaign."
Yes, McKinley let the people come to him, to his own front door. As the campaign progresses, the strain begins to tell on the traveling Bryan, and he starts to lose his grip, while McKinley stays home to win. So did the political campaign grow from its beginning 120 years ago. Today, there's nothing haphazard or unrehearsed. Behind every major candidate, there is today a smooth, efficient organization involving hundreds of workers, talents, and services, which, as far as humanly possible, has each campaign planned out in detail in advance.
Let us examine the truth of this, America. See for ourselves how election campaigns, in the midst of living, 1948, are carried on.
Republican National Committee.
First, supporting the roster of candidates for each party and set up long before the candidate is elected, stands a national committee. Purpose?
To establish headquarters, plan strategy, collect money.
Campaigns are expensive. In 1940, the Democrats were $423,000 in the hole. The Republicans, $340,000.
Organization of the committee.
Top man, National Committee Chairman.
For the Democrats in this campaign, J. Howard McGrath. For the Republicans, Hugh Scott.
Under the National Committee Chairman are the Vice Chairman, Secretary, Treasurer, and so on. State and local committees are usually set up in the same way. Workers on the staff of the various committees break down into...
I work for the committee because I get paid for it.
I hold my regular job, thanks to the party, so you can see why I work for it.
I've volunteered my help because I believe in the cause.
In 1896, the Republican National Committee hired 1,400 workers. In 1920, 15,000. This election year, an estimated 1 million persons will actually participate in the campaigns of all parties.
Specialized services supplied by these workers. Listen.
Press department. Yes. Yes.
No, the release date on
the
that
press
story...
department to see that newspapers get publicity stories, cartoons, advance copies of speeches, editorial
campaign literature. 200 copies of the acceptance speech.
Advertising. What's that? Our billboard man? Just hold on.
In 1936, the Republicans spent $800,000 on billboard advertising alone.
I'll have that ready for you at 2 o'clock.
Writers are hired to ghost the hundreds of speeches that will be delivered.
Radio and television section. No, we're reserving that evening time for the...
In 1940, both parties earmarked 20% of their campaign budget for radio alone, averaging $360,000 each. This year, something new will be added. Television, with big, strong He-Man candidates worrying about...
Say, George, how's my makeup?
The chief director of the party's destiny is...
The campaign manager.
Few campaign managers can match the record of Jim Farley, who guided Franklin Roosevelt to his early landslides and had one of the best-run campaign organizations in political history. Of the 1936 campaign, Russell Owen said...
Behind Mr. Farley, there are as many sections as Pershing had in France. There's a service of supply that sent out pamphlets and speakers and buys what's necessary. There's a library and filing service to keep in touch. There's an intelligence service to find out what's going on in the enemy camp. These men do not deny espionage, but they do deny safe-cracking and burglary.
Well, this, then, is the huge party organization set up behind the nation's leading candidates, and its influence seeps all the way down to the smallest ward or precinct, where local leaders of the local political machine do the payoff work of getting out the vote, even if they have to call for the voters and drag them down in limousines.
This year, the presidential candidates have declared their intention of swinging for it to carry today's issues, like high prices and housing, before the people.
Want to see what such a swing involves, America? Okay. Imagine I say that you're a presidential candidate on a typical campaign tour of the country.
You're up in a long train consisting of one car for you, the nominee, and sometimes your family. One or two dining cars, cars for the campaign workers, cars for the working press. You're equipped with...
Here are your speeches, sir.
Enough speeches written ahead to last for several days, and a good line plan that will fit for any stop you make. Oh, you're expected to get little sleep.
Wake up, sir.
Huh? Well, what time is it?
12:45 a.m. There's a crowd waiting for you at the station.
You get up, go out.
My friends and fellow Americans.
You go back to sleep. You're tired. You're exhausted.
Wake up, sir.
It's 5 a.m. Out you go again.
My friends and fellow Americans.
Now you arrive at a town where one of your wealthy party supporters climbs aboard and announces...
I've organized a parade in your honor.
And you want me to...
To review it, of course. To review it.
But later, as you sit down to dinner...
I'm sorry, sir. They insist on seeing you.
What can you do? You can't say no. Then, too, wherever the train stops, some delegation gets on, and sure as fate, one of them buttonholes you, professing...
I must speak to you in private. You've got to understand the delicate party situation here.
You're expected to settle local party disputes, and you must be careful, as non-committal as possible.
Yes, of course.
Now you're stopping overnight to speak at some big local affair. You learn that...
Both ladies are rival social leaders. Both want to entertain you, but the one with the screwball hat...
You choose the most politically advantageous invitation. Or perhaps instead off to a hotel, a shower, a change of clothes, and then through the streets in an open car to a rally.
My friends and fellow Americans.
Sometimes there's a heckler in the crowd, a heckler who demands...
I want to know why you signed that bill.
But you've learned to deal with hecklers by now. First, you urge the crowd.
Wait. Let the American citizen have his say.
And when the question is repeated...
I want to know why you signed that bill.
Yes.
you answer.
I signed it for you, sir. For all of you.
And so it goes on and on and on.
What place is this, St. Louis?
No, this is Cincinnati.
Oh, I thought the last stop was Cincinnati.
No, that was St. Louis.
Well, it doesn't matter. My friends and fellow Americans.
No, no one will deny that it's a long, hard campaign pull to the presidency. But of course, as always, the overwhelming number of aspirants will be candidates for other offices. In this election year, for
32 Senate seats, 435 seats in the House, 32 state governorships, seats in state legislatures, city councils, offices of mayors, judges, justices of peace, sheriffs, animal inspectors. Name something.
Except for the congressional seats, here no national issues will limit debate. No councils of strategy interfere. Here on this local plane especially, we can see politics functioning as the laboratory of applied psychology. And for the proof of this pudding, we have to look at the candidates of our most recent history.
The Pied Pipers, or the singing candidates.
Attaboy! Paul Columbine! Thank you, voters. Thank you. I will next sing for you a little ditty of my own titled, You Are My Sunshine. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, dear.
That, friends, is how Jim Davis rose to be governor of Louisiana.
Friends, I didn't really want to conduct a hillbilly campaign, but after my first two speeches, I could see the folks weren't interested in hearing me talk. So I went home and got my boys and said, boys, tune up your fiddle. Tomorrow night, we're going to give them what they want.
That night and every night thereafter, Jim Davis gave the voters music. And for practically every note he sang, he got a vote in return.
The Bible Men.
Many candidates have learned the value of couching their platform in biblical terms. Sample, the late Senator Bilbo of Mississippi.
Bilbo's hour has arrived. For him, victory is writ.
Such tactics helped assure this man, declared by his state legislature to be unfit to sit with honest, upright men in respectable legislative body, helped him assure him of election to the state Senate, Lieutenant Governor, Governor, U.S. Senator.
Yea, in the fair stars above, as it'll be recorded by the ballots here below.
Men of the people.
Jeff Fowler sent this letter out to his Democratic constituents.
As for myself, I'm an Arkansas hillbilly. Outran the dogs on Sunday morning to keep from having my face washed. Did my sparking barefoot. Never saw a train till I was 15. And was most grown before I learned Republicans walk not a hind feet like people.
Roaring Bob Reynolds of North Carolina won by describing to the voters what his opponent was eating in Washington.
Friends, it pains me to tell you. Caviar, that's what he eats. Fish eggs from Red Russia. Now, fellow citizens, let me ask you. Do you want a senator who ain't too high and mighty to eat good old North Carolina hen eggs? Or don't you?
The tightrope walkers.
Scene, the rear platform of a railroad coach paused in the Northwest. The issue, shall the local mountain be named Mount Rainier or Mount Tacoma? Either way you decide, you're bound to lose votes. But the politician in this case was equal to that problem. From the rear of the train, he'd shout,
this controversy must be settled and settled right. I pledge myself, here and now, that if elected, I will not rest until this glorious mountain is properly named. There is only one appellation which is worthy of consideration, and that is Mount. I thank you.
Well, Was he for Tacoma or Rainier? Those for Rainier thought and swore he said Rainier. The Tacoma fans, Tacoma. And no one could deny either conclusion for sure. For the train whistle blowing on cue always drowned him out. These, America, are but a few of our documented samples of American political campaign techniques. And now the question before us is...
Do campaigns really change votes?
I'll take that, Clyde.
And we'll gladly pass that hot potato to you, Dr. Gallup. Friends, this is Dr. George Gallup, whom you all know from the Gallup poll.
For 13 years, Clyde, we've been collecting, through our polls, information on the voting behavior of the American people.
And what did you learn about the effect of campaigns on votes?
Clyde, as far as our presidential campaigns are concerned, in a very real sense, they're over before they begin.
What do you mean, Dr. Gallup?
People just don't start off a campaign year with completely open minds. They don't listen to campaign arguments, judge the evidence, and then go out and vote.
No?
No, sir. Their minds are made up to a great extent by what happens between presidential elections, rather than by the campaign. In short, their minds are made up ahead of campaign time.
Any proof?
Plenty. But just let me give you two examples. In May of 1940, we found 57% of the nation's voters planning to vote for Roosevelt for a third term. They didn't even know who the Republican candidate was going to be. As it happened, it turned out to be Wilkie. 6 months later, on Election Day, the people gave Roosevelt 55%, only 2% less than said they would vote for him before the campaign began.
Well, I'll be darned.
In 1944, they made up their minds even earlier. Our poll in April showed...
Roosevelt, 55%.
Dewey, 45%.
In November, the vote divided...
Roosevelt, 54%. Dewey, 46%.
Scarcely any important difference at all.
Well, then the platform and speeches and everything...
Clyde, 3 weeks after the Republicans published their platform in 1944... We made a coast-to-coast poll to find out...
Have you read any part of the Republican platform?
Two-thirds of the Americans poll said...
No, I didn't.
Me either.
Only one farmer in 10 could recall anything it said about agriculture. Only one worker in 16, anything it said about labor or jobs.
Well, now, wait a minute. If that's the case, a political party could give up campaigning and win. Maybe they could save all that time and money and talk.
I hardly think so, Clyde. Apparently, some kind of campaign is wise to keep in line those who do make up their minds early.
Well, then, what would you say this all proved about us, Dr. Gallup?
Well, apparently, Clyde, two contradictory things. First...
That can't fool me with all that campaign stuff.
That our voters are too smart to be taken in by the campaigns which are so often fought on an incredibly low plane. And two...
I vote for the best man. But the best man's always a Democrat.
We're not smart enough yet to overcome the human weakness of voting by habit, with little regard for thinking about candidates or issues.
Which leaves us smack up against our last question, Dr. Gallup, namely...
How can we cast an intelligent ballot?
There again, the answer is two-pronged, Clyde. One, let our politicians look to the campaigns. Let them present campaign issues in a manner that is sportsmanlike and intelligent.
And...
Let us, as individuals, cease being political creatures of habit and become open-minded voters. At a time like this, with great issues at stake the world over, we can least afford poor leaders at any level. And certainly we cannot afford the luxury of voting by blind habit. Only by showing more independence in our political thinking, by choosing candidates intelligently all the way down the line, can we make this land we love a stronger, healthier democracy for all of us.
Living 1948 is prepared and presented for the University of the Air by the NBC Public Affairs staff under the supervision of Wade Arnold, with scripts written by Lou Hazem. Technical advice is by Jane Tiffany Wagner, music conducted by Milton Katims, and program direction by James Harvey. Your narrator was Clyde Cattell, assisted today by Dr. George Gallup of the American Institute of Public Opinion. We invite you to keep abreast of Living 1948 by listening next week to another drama document.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.